The Crime Tree is a true crime podcast detailing the crimes and events committed against others. Listener discretion is advised. The first instances of the use of forensic science date back to the Egyptian, Roman, and Greek empires. Around 3000 BC, Egyptian civilizations were performing the first practices of what is essentially an autopsy. Through their religious practices of removing and examining the internal organs of the deceased during their mummification process. But the first officially recorded autopsy was not until the death on March 15, 44 BC of Roman general and politician Julius Caesar. Roman practitioner Antistius found that despite being stabbed 23 times, Julius Caesar was killed by only one of those, which was to his chest. That's not to say that he would have survived any or all of the other 22 stab wounds, especially back in 44 BC. The first acquittal of an innocent man was made by using very basic forensic science by Roman orator and jurist Quintilian way back in the 1st century AD. The 13th century saw the first published guide to pathology in a Chinese book by Song Si, called Ziyuan Lu, or The Washing Away of Wrongs. This book includes the first written testimony of the use of medicine and entomology to solve crimes and to help determine the cause of death. The book explained how the examination of weapons or tools and the damage they cause on the body or bones can help to distinguish the difference between a murder and an accidental death, and how to calculate the time of death by analysing the environment and insect activity. In 1835, Henry Goddard became the first to connect a bullet to a weapon using basic physical analysis. And 85 years later came the introduction of the comparison microscope, which changed the way bullets were linked to guns and how tools were matched with striation marks. In 1896, the Henry classification system was adopted worldwide as the standard for criminal fingerprinting techniques. And in the 1970s, the method of detecting gunshot residue was developed by scientists at the Aerospace Corporation in California. And although many of these processes have vastly changed, these are still techniques used by forensic investigators to this day. I guess what I'm trying to say is that the use of forensic science, no matter how basic, has been in use for far longer than what many people realise. But it was Edmund Lockhart's 1910 formulation of the concept that everything leaves a trace that is the basis of the methods used by forensic investigators in crime scenes all around the world to this day. Now known as Lockhart's exchange principle, it states that everything and everyone who enters a crime scene leaves a piece of evidence behind, and everything and everyone who leaves a crime scene takes a piece of it with them. With the modern advancements such as DNA profiling and high-tech computerized systems, the work of the forensic investigator has become both more complex and more straightforward. Straightforward in the sense that these days DNA can quickly incriminate or exclude someone from an investigation. But before the introduction of advanced DNA technology, forensic investigators had to rely more than ever on their own ability in locating, analysing and interpreting the evidence that had been left at the scene of a crime and what had been taken away, which more often than not could be of very little value in obtaining that crucial link between victim and perpetrator that's needed to secure a conviction. But then there are the rare crime scenes that contain such an overwhelming amount of forensic evidence that even before the use of DNA, it can result in a quick open and shut case. You are listening to The Crime Tree. I'm your host, Jasmine, and this is the story of Florence Hildreth. As the sun rose across the farmland surrounding Delano, California, in rural Kern County on September 7, 1987, a local farmer discovered the body of a young woman. She was lying on her back, naked, except for her top, which was pulled up around her neck. Her jeans, shoes, and underwear were located not far from where she lay. She was found on one of the many isolated soft dirt roads that crisscrossed throughout Delano's surrounding agricultural region. This particular road was several kilometres outside of Delano and just south of Cecil Avenue. Cecil Avenue is Delano's main drag, which runs through the town and extends out to the east, where it eventually brings you to the Porterville Highway. And it is this stretch of road between the town and the highway that has numerous dirt tracks that run both north and south that are seldom travelled except by the farmers to get from one paddock to another. And that's exactly what this farmer was doing in the beautiful morning hours of the Labor Day holiday on Monday the 7th of September 1987. Police were quick to arrive at the scene and the surrounding area was cordoned off. The victim was quickly noted as being a young female, possibly in her late teens or early 20s. She had wounds to her head and face and what appeared to be stab wounds to her neck. Her top was pushed up above her breasts, and when it was moved, numerous links from a broken gold-coloured chain fell from within its folds. On the ground near the body were clear tyre impressions, and near the tyre impressions were clear shoe impressions, and near the shoe impressions were clear handprints and drag marks. The soft dirt of this secluded road had captured the life and death struggle between this victim and her killer. The woman's clothing was scattered nearby, and beside her was a bloodied and broken knife. In the pocket of her jeans, officers found a keychain with the letter F attached to it, along with two keys, one slightly smaller than the other. There was no form of identification to be found. While the crime scene was being analysed and processed, one officer set about trying to uncover the identity of their victim. There were no missing persons reports matching her description, so all he had to go on was the set of keys found in her pocket. Coming to the conclusion that the keys were most likely the keys to someone's front door and mailbox, the officers started at the north side of Delano and tried the smaller key in every apartment complex mailbox that he came across. He repeated this process over and over hundreds of times as he headed in a southward direction, being careful not to miss a single mailbox. By early afternoon, he got a hit. The key fit the mailbox for apartment number 3 in a complex located in Delano's middle working class area. The occupants of this apartment were Christine Hildreth, a registered nurse who worked at the local hospital, and her 17-year-old daughter, Florence Yvette Hildreth, who was affectionately known as Mimi to her family and friends. Florence was born on March the 13th, 1970 in Los Angeles, California, to parents Christine and Everett Hildreth. She was the youngest of four children with two older sisters, Janine and Phyllis, and an older brother, Alan. Her parents separated when she was around 5 years old, and the Hildreth children moved with their mother to Delano, where many members of her mother's family already resided. By the time Florence was 17, she was the only one of her siblings still at home. She was about to enter her senior year at Delano High School, where she was an honor roll student, a cheerleader, a member of the track and field team, and was the vice president of the student union. Florence was a bright, smart, and bubbly girl with the whole world ahead of her. Her dream was to study medicine, and everyone described her as a good kid. The summer school holidays were just coming to an end, and Florence was days away from beginning her senior year. So how did she end up murdered and dumped on a secluded road on the outskirts of town? Christine Hildreth told investigators that on the evening of Sunday, September the 6th, her daughter was spending the night at the home of her aunt, Diane Pruitt. Aunt Diane told them that about 10:30 p.m. Florence announced that she was going for a quick walk around to see her cousin Crystal at the house of her aunt and uncle Brenda and Martin Clark, which was only several blocks away. The Clarks confirmed that Florence had arrived at their place just after 10:30 p.m. She stayed for about 15 minutes before leaving to head back to her Aunt Diane's house. Her Uncle Martin offered to walk with her, but she declined and went on her way. But 17-year-old Florence never arrived at her destination. Back at the crime scene, detectives were still busy processing the area. Focusing on the tyre impressions, they found that three of the tyres were the same, but the right front tyre was different. This right front tyre had even left its sidewall impression along the edge of a small mound of dirt. The impression was so clear that not only were the tyre's unique characteristics visible, but the impression from the sidewall had left the letters D, S, and V imprinted in the dirt. This was quickly recognised as being the vehicle's spare tyre that had the words "limited service" printed along its edge. The shoe impressions were just as clear and could be identified immediately as a fairly new size 12 pair of Brooks brand athletic shoes. There was only one set of shoe prints, and along with the handprints and drag marks, it was clear that Florence had put up a struggle. and it painted a picture of her terrifying last moments. It was presumed that Florence had been dragged from the vehicle by her legs. She landed on her buttocks with her hands face down behind her and was dragged through the dirt. It was assumed that Florence was already naked from the waist down when she was pulled from the vehicle, as she suffered abrasions and bruisings from the struggle. And due to the isolation of the area, no one would have heard her desperate cries for help. It was also clear from the amount of blood on and around her that Florence had been killed at the spot she lay. The medical examiner was quickly able to determine her cause of death, as multiple stab wounds to her neck, including one fatal stab wound in the front of her neck on the right side, which had nicked her carotid artery. She had also suffered blunt force trauma to the head and face, consistent with being punched multiple times. She had numerous cuts and abrasions covering her body, and two pubic hairs were found stuck to the left side of her head. She had been sexually assaulted, and vaginal swabs revealed the presence of blood, sperm, and semen. There were no drugs or alcohol in her system, and all of her injuries had been inflicted before death. The medical examiner also noted some strange abrasions and bruisings to her right cheek, markings very similar to the shoe impressions left at the crime scene. It was determined that as she lay dying, her attacker had stood on her face for up to 5 minutes. Florence's family and friends told investigators that she would never have gotten to a vehicle with someone she didn't know, and would have put up one heck of a fight if someone had tried snatching her. They insisted that if she had willingly got in the car with someone, then it was someone she knew and trusted. Someone she knew meant her no harm, and would safely get her to where she needed to be. As investigators were still at the scene, a local approached one of the police roadblocks and informed them that she had seen a red pickup truck stopped in that area as she drove into town along Cecil Avenue late the night before. A red pickup truck in this area is not uncommon, but she said that this truck stood out to her because as her headlights lit it up, she could see that it had ski racks fitted to its roof. Delano is a farming community in the south of California's Central Valley, an area that doesn't see snow. So if you're in Delano with ski racks on your vehicle, it's going to stand out. And Florence's family knew exactly who this vehicle belonged to. 21-year-old Rodney Berryman was born in 1965 in Cheyenne, Wyoming, and was the second oldest of four children. His father served in the Air Force and his mother was a homemaker. Outward appearances were that this was a normal and happy household, but behind closed doors, Rodney's father was a violent and abusive man, regularly beating his wife in the presence of their children. At around the age of 7, his parents eventually separated and later divorced. Rodney and his brothers and sister were often shuffled between the houses of their mother, their father, as well as other family members who resided in Delano. Because of this, Rodney had spent quite a bit of time in the area and had maintained some friendships and relationships with people in Delano despite spending most of his adolescence in Los Angeles, where after his father passed away, he had begun abusing alcohol and getting into trouble with the law. In early 1986, at the age of just 20, he met and married Carol Lynn Fuller, and the two set up house in Los Angeles County. Carol's father was the pastor of a local church, and Rodney became involved in the church as he attempted to stay out of trouble. But when Carol gave birth to their son, Rodney Jr., before the year was out, Rodney cracked under the mounting pressure he felt he was under. He began drinking more, and before his son's first birthday, Rodney had abandoned Carol and their baby. In August 1987, he and his trusty red, black, and grey Mitsubishi pickup truck arrived in Delano and to the house of Florence's aunt and uncle, Brenda and Martin Clark, and cousin Crystal, the same house that Florence had briefly visited just moments before she vanished. Rodney was known to the Clark family as he had briefly dated Crystal a few years earlier, and the two had remained friends. So when Rodney arrived and needed a place to stay for a while, the Clarks were quick to welcome him with open arms. In the few short weeks that he'd been back in Delano, Florence had met and hung out with him on numerous occasions and would have been comfortable enough to accept a lift from him should he offer. So within 12 hours of Florence's body being found, Rodney Berryman was sitting in an interrogation room with detectives asking him about his movements since the previous night. He told them that on Sunday the 6th of September, he and Florence's cousin Crystal had driven to Bakersfield, approximately a 30-minute drive south of Delano. They spent the afternoon there, returning back to the Clark house at around 8:30 p.m. The two ate some lasagna for dinner that Crystal's mum Brenda had cooked earlier that evening. Then at about 9 p.m. he left the Clark house alone. He said he then drove the short distance to the house of local woman Donna Warner in the hopes of being able to get her to have sex with him. She refused, so he drove to another woman's house, Melinda Pena, and tried his luck again. This time he was successful and the two drove out to the nearby lake where they had sex on the grass beside the truck. He told detectives that after dropping her home, he then drove back to the Clark household where Crystal warmed him up another plate of lasagna before eating and falling asleep. After waking that morning, he said that he went to the nearby park for a game of basketball with some mates, but had otherwise remained at the Clark house. Crystal confirmed all of this but was unsure of what time he had returned to the house the previous night. The Clarks were certain, however, that Rodney was not there when Florence had briefly stopped by. While talking to the detectives, other officers went out to the car park to check the tyres on Rodney's truck and were shocked to find that all four were the same, which was inconsistent with the marks left near Florence's body. A quick look through the vehicle's windows also revealed nothing immediately suspicious, and there was no obvious signs of a struggle. The detectives had noted a small scratch to the side of Rodney's nose, and when asked about this, he told them that he had got it during his basketball game that morning. Rodney admitted to knowing Florence, but was adamant that she had never been in his truck. And when informed about the eyewitness reports of his truck being seen out near the site of where Florence's body was found late the night before, Rodney swore black and blue that this witness was clearly mistaken. He then told investigators that he had never even driven on Cecil Avenue, which is pretty hard to avoid if you are residing in the area. As Rodney was preparing himself to leave the interrogation room, an eagle-eyed detective noticed that he was wearing what looked to be a newish pair of Brooks athletic shoes, and on closer examination, one shoe had several splatters of what appeared to be blood on the side of it, as well as on the shoelace. Samples of the blood from the shoes was taken and sent to forensics for analysis. This was before the use of DNA, so the analysis tested the blood using a technique called electrophoresis. Electrophoresis is used to analyze the proteins found in human blood. An electrical current is passed through the sample, which reveals a unique set of enzymes. The tests show that the blood found on Rodney's shoes was unique to 0.068% of the African American population. The same 0.068% that Florence was shown to belong to, and that Rodney did not. For pre-DNA testing, this was a pretty strong indicator that the blood found on Rodney's shoes belonged to Florence Hildreth. Detectives then went back out to the Clark property in the hopes of finding anything to link Florence to Rodney, and in the backyard leaning up against the rear of the house was a spare tyre with the words "limited service" printed around the sidewall. Florence's uncle Martin told the investigators that the tyre was not there the previous day and he had no idea where it had come from. The tyre and shoes were then sent to criminalist Greg Lukowski to see if he could match them to the impressions taken from the crime scene. Using material similar in consistency to the soft dirt where Florence's body was found, Greg Lukowski made his own impressions, photographed them, and attempted to match them to the photographs taken from the scene. Both the shoe and the tyre were a match, right down to the unique characteristics of each. These unique characteristics are known as accidental markings and can occur during the manufacturing process and from normal wear and tear. Further examination of Rodney's truck revealed some small gold-coloured links under the driver's seat. These links were visibly similar to the links found from Florence's broken necklace, which fell from the folds of her top when moved. These two were sent over to Greg Lukowski, and under examination it was found that both the links taken from Florence's body and the links found in Rodney's truck were made with the same tool. To make a chain, the manufacturing process involves each link to be cut using a tiny tool. Then each link is attached by crimping the edges back together. Under a microscope, the distinctive marks from the tool used are clearly visible. These marks are known as striations and they run across the length of the cut surface. The striations of each tool are unique and they are created when the tool is made and from the tool being used. And by using a comparison microscope, Greg Lukowski showed them to be a perfect match. The examination of Rodney's truck also revealed a single thumbprint on the inside surface of the passenger window, a thumbprint that belonged to Florence. And further analysis of the two pubic hairs found stuck to Florence's head showed one to be consistent with the pubic hair of Rodney and the other to be consistent with her own. Another witness then came forward to tell investigators that they had witnessed Rodney's truck leaving a local convenience store along Cecil Avenue at around 11 p.m. on the night Florence vanished. The witness remembered the truck, again due to its ski racks. The witness said that there were two people in the vehicle, the driver and a female passenger, and that when they left the parking lot, they turned to drive in the direction toward where Florence's body was later found. The witness said that other than the truck being fitted with ski racks, nothing else seemed out of the ordinary. Less than 24 hours after her body being found, Florence Hildreth's killer, Rodney Berryman Sr., was under arrest and charged with capital murder and rape, to which he pleaded not guilty and was sent to trial by jury. At trial, the already large amount of forensic evidence was shown to the jury. It also heard testimony from the young men who had played basketball with Rodney on the morning Florence's body was found. Rodney had claimed that the scratch on his nose had occurred during the game, but the men told the courts that they had noticed the scratch prior to the game commencing. Florence's body had been found by this time, but it was still yet to be identified. However, the men Rodney was playing with said he told them that the body found was Florence's and that she had been stabbed. He claimed that she had met her death at the hands of some people from Los Angeles and told them that he was looking to buy a gun to quote-unquote get them back. It was theorized that after Rodney had dropped Melinda Penner home, he then began driving back to the Clark house. This was when he came across Florence, having just left the same house he was traveling to. Florence was acquainted with Rodney and would not have felt uncomfortable getting into his truck. The two stopped at the convenience store before Rodney drove her out to the secluded back roads on the outskirts of Delano. It is thought that when they stopped, Rodney made a sexual advancement towards Florence, to which she would have strongly rejected. A struggle then ensued as Rodney attempted to drag her from the truck. Her necklace broke in the struggle, with some of the links coming to rest under the driver's seat. After dragging Florence through the dirt, Rodney punched her numerous times in the face and head in an attempt to get her to stop struggling. He then raped the terrified girl before stabbing her multiple times in the neck, nicking her carotid artery, the knife breaking in the process. Rodney then stood upon her face until she was dead. On December the 5th, 1988, Rodney Berryman Sr. was found guilty and sentenced to death. He is currently on death row at San Quentin Prison, and in the years since, all of his appeals have been rejected. The funeral for Florence Yvette Hildreth was held on Friday, September the 11th, 1987, at the Chapel of Congregations. She was laid to rest at the North Kern Cemetery in Delano, California. Thank you for listening. Please join us again next week. We'll bring you another story picked fresh straight from the crime tree. All photos pertaining to this case will be up on our Instagram @thecrimetree.